listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the conservative... What is CPAC?
Conservative Political Action.
Political Action Conference. There you go. CPAC. I've been doing CPAC for 6 years, and I've never... it's always CPAC. I just do political action. Jonathan, by the way, Jonathan Crone is with us, and a freelance journalist and writer. Is there a website you'd like to push people to for the work you're doing right now, Jonathan?
Yeah, I'm actually... I just got a fellowship with the network Rudow in Kurdistan, and... you can check it out at Rudaw, rudaw.net/English if you want to read it in English and not in Kurdish.
Okay, great.
That would be better. And the new site launches tomorrow, so it's they're revamping the whole site.
We'll get that up on our website with a push to you. So for those of you who were watching this program when I was at CPAC 3 years ago, 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, I'm not sure. I was here. I've been here for at least 6 years. And this 12, 13-year-old kid comes over and says, I want to debate you, and was one of the actually few people who actually gave me a run for my money. So many of the people just have, they're fairly shallow in their understanding of issues and their knowledge of things. And Jonathan, you were one of the smartest guys. You still are one of the smartest guys I know. I really enjoyed meeting you. I really enjoyed debating you.
Thank you.
And... welcome back to the program, first of all, but secondly, you're not here to debate me as a conservative any longer.
No. I don't like to give myself an ideological label. I'd like to think I'm more left than right, but I feel that personally, it was a lack of maturity to think that I could know everything at the age of 12, and I still don't know everything.
Well, can I posit something for you? I used to own an ad agency. I used to teach advertising. I've been in the marketing world for 30 years on and off. The primary message of in good, effective advertising, I mean, good and effective advertising, of course, communicates, but in mass market consumer advertising, the main message is you are the most important person in the world, right? That's the main message that the advertiser conveys to the person that they're advertising to. It produces an infantilism. It produces I'm the center of the world. I'm the most important person. And at its core, that's the message of libertarianism and conservatism, is that if every individual thinks of themselves as the most important person in the world and pursues their own self-interest, then the world will be a better place. You know, this is
I mean, I think that... for me, it was something that was very safe, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up around conservatism. I grew up in a conservative household. I grew up around conservative friends and conservative church and all that.
Yeah.
I didn't really have a lot of people challenging those views.
Right.
And I think for me, it really was when I took an opportunity to just not take myself so seriously. You know, to let myself think. And mull over the things that I had written in the past and talked about in the past, and just think for myself and read other things that weren't necessarily politically related, like philosophy and so forth.
Right.
It was when I started doing that I started to realize, you know, it's not really about one ideology or the other. It's about what's right and what's true and what actually is correct.
And what works.
Yeah, and what works and what's pragmatic and what's real.
And I would say the main left-right divide in my mind has historically been a we me. Either it's a we society or it's a me society, and which is why I was mentioning the infantilism and this but you know, we're digressing in philosophy
here.
I suppose. So you're going to Kurdistan?
Yes. I'm leaving for Kurdish Iraq in May to work out of Erbil, or Howler as it's said in Kurdish, but that's where Rudaw is based out of. That's the capital of the Kurdish regional government.
Wow.
In Iraq, and so
it's amazing
I'm
stuff.
Very excited to go there.
The for 30 years or more, I've worked for an international relief agency as a volunteer, and have gone into a whole bunch of weird and awful places around the world, from I was mentioning the Karen refugees on the border of Burma and Thailand to being in Uganda during the war. But the guy who founded the organization, his name was Gottfried Mueller, and he designed what was, at 10 years ago anyway, the modern flag of the Kurdish resistance movement when they were fighting against Saddam. I don't know if it's still their flag or not.
You mean the star?
It's
the
Yeah. He designed that flag years ago.
That's the main star. That's the main flag of Kurdistan as a nation.
Yeah.
That's the national symbol. There are different flags for different groups, obviously.
Yeah. He was good friends with. He was a German spy in World War II, and he was parachuted into Kurdistan. He knew the Kurds, and he was going to try and help them get the oil for Hitler. And he parachuted in to a British camp. His brother was a very aggressive peace activist, and he had been starting to work with his brother, and he got outed, and so he got immediately arrested and spent the rest of the war in a prison. But was really, so that's a whole long story. I wrote a book called The Prophet's Way about his life. But in any case, I have a special place in my heart for Kurdistan because of all the stories I've heard from Herr Mueller over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting locale, and I think that for a lot of Americans, it's hard to understand because we don't hear about them that much.
Yeah.
You know, we don't hear about them. They're kind of
put
to the side. And
Northern
Iraq. It's also in northern Syria.
Southwestern Turkey.
Exactly.
Southeastern Turkey.
And northwestern kind of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that entire region.
So I'm curious your thoughts on CPAC. Here we are. It's been all these years. We've debated each other.
Yeah.
But, you know,
every time I've been here.
Yeah. Until now.
Until now.
So
this is history in the making.
It, in my mind, coming to CPAC is kind of like going to the zoo. And I don't mean that in a dismissive way. It's like, wow, there's so much going on here. It's so interesting. There are some people who are kind of like going, you know, just funny. But there are a lot of really serious people too.
Well, I mean, the way they organize the media this year, they have like a pin for the media. So I mean, I understand the zoo metaphor there as well, because the last panel they were doing, it was just making fun of everybody that's in the media, saying American journalism is dead, journalists are terrible. That's literally, I mean, those were the comments they were making about us, who were there, like, I don't know, there are probably maybe 100 or so of us. There are a ton
Who's
of us.
Who's the they who was saying this?
Joel Pollack from Breitbart, and I don't remember the other guys.
Breitbart's the media,
at least they
pretend they are.
They claim they are, but they say they claim they're journalists, you know.
Yeah.
But that's
the only real ones.
I don't get how you can say American journalism is dead and then promote your site as real journalism. By that token, you're just saying, we're real journalism because we agree with this and we don't agree with you, so you're not real.
Yeah.
It's like the whole real America, fake America thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's something, though, you know, to I guess we all have to own up to this, on both the right and the left. I mean, the main message of Fox News is don't trust the rest of the media. And frankly, one of my main messages is don't trust the rest of the media. And I think that it's because, And they have a point here, you know, starting in 86 when Reagan blew up the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine had nothing to do with if Limbaugh is on, I have to be on. What it said was that if you carry over the radio or television airwaves signal, you must perform public service. And that was news. And that's why all the news divisions lost money, because they actually did news. When he stopped that, they all came under the entertainment divisions. They're all now driven by ratings. It's all about eyeballs and Balloon Boy and, you know.
Yeah, you got to... I think nowadays you definitely have to be aware of bias, and you got to be able to discern what things are biased and what things aren't. You got to choose for yourself.
And I think even more importantly, not just bias, but the stupidity of infotainment. But Jonathan Crone, once again, the website.
Rudaw, rudaw.net/English.
Thank you, Jonathan. Great to have you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That was Jonathan Crone, K-R-O-H-N, R-U-D-O-W, you said?
R-U-D-A-W.
A-W, A-W.net. Thank you. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference Committee. Conference. Yeah, there we go. And Scotty Nell Hughes is with us. I have it right?
You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
Hey, you're really good at this talk radio.
I can read a name.
Well, that's a lot more than a lot of other people in media
and
can do sometimes.
Scotty is the director and chief journalist at the Tea Party News Network.
Yes.
And the website for that is finance.townhall.com. Do I have
that's
that
my
right?
town hall column, but okay. I'm also TPNN.com is for town.
TPNN.com.
Tea Party News
Great.
Network.
There you go. And Twitter at Scotty N. Hughes?
I am making this really difficult, aren't I? I'm a typical Republican. I make things more complicated than what they should be.
No, it's all kinds of cool stuff. Well, you said typical Republican. Tea Party and Republican don't seem to be mixing really well in some areas. I got John McCain on the floor of the Senate railing about the Tea Party. What's going on?
Yes, and that's why we lost in November. And until the Republicans learn to play nice in the sandbox and get along, a.k.a. play like the conservatives want them to, we're going to continue to lose.
So,
and that's the message we're sending today, I think, with this conference.
So the message is our way or the highway to the Republican Party.
We're never going to win. That, for some reason, someone in the Republican Party kept telling us that we needed moderates. They gave us McCain. They gave us Romney. Go back to Bob Dole. For some reason, the way we need to elect people is with zero.
Bush Sr. was a moderate.
Bush Sr.
Bush Jr. didn't really run as a conservative. I mean, he ran on immigration reform.
He started off.
He ran on strong social safety net. I mean, he didn't want to privatize Social Security until his second term.
Well, of course, a lot of things happened in the second term, and I think that's something that the Democrats are learning right now.
But
the second term is always a whole different picture than the first term.
But isn't the big message that the Republicans are saying to you folks in the Tea Party, Barry Goldwater?
What the Republicans are saying in the Tea Party, actually I'm finding that I think there's more of a minority in the Republican Party that have agreed to have been the louder squeaky wheel that have pushed these moderates on us.
Right.
In reality, you look at the success back in the fall, Chick-fil-A. You look at the passion that came out after the filibuster with Rand Paul, the only bipartisan effort I've seen truly in Washington, D.C. in years. Because people want to get excited. Republicans want to get excited about something.
Well, Rand Paul was on the right side of that issue. I mean, I did an op-ed supporting him. Even though we all acknowledge it was a stunt, but good on him. I mean, you know, politics is half theater. It was brilliant. How do progressives get the Democratic Party to do what you, arguably hard right conservatives, for lack of a better, or Tea Party conservatives, have gotten the Republican Party to do? How'd you do this to the Republican Party?
Well, we didn't do it to the Republican Party. The problem is the Republican Party, the reason why we lost is because they sat there and they gave us a moderate and nobody wanted to go out. The true Republicans in this country are conservative, strict constitutionalists, and want the government to stay out of their homes and out of their cities.
No more Social Security, no more Medicare. Get rid of all that stuff.
Not necessarily get rid of it, but the problem is we need to make sure that we reform it. Republicans
Turn it over to a private corporation so they can make a buck on it.
Hey, I'm a capitalist, so I agree on any of those sorts of things. But let me say this. One thing that the Democrats do wonderful that I think the Republicans need to learn a lesson of, you very rarely hear of Democrats squabbling. And it's almost, I mean, you hear of a little here and there. Nowhere to the scale that we're hearing of the Republicans today.
Right.
For my side, bad for you, good for me. It's not an election year, number one. Number two, we are going to get this worked out. And number three, hopefully we don't take too much carnage of good conservatives like we did in our primary in our wake of all of this.
Yeah. Well, the Progressive Caucus, we had Raul Grijalva on the radio show yesterday and Keith Ellison on our TV show. They released they call it the back-to-work budget. I mean, it's an actual budget. It pretty much balances the budget within 10 years, just like Paul Ryan's. Instead of having all the, and then Congress has to figure out what to cut, and then Congress has to figure out what to raise. You know, there's all those holes in Paul Ryan's budget. This actually disclosed everything, but the Democratic Party is largely ignoring it. So.
And that makes you wonder. See, so there is a little bit of issues in the Democratic, but you guys are doing a much better job of hiding it. Maybe it helps that you've got most of the media on your side, so they're not going to promote that.
I don't think we're hiding it. I just don't think it's happening.
You know, well, let me just say this. Being at both conventions, if I was to sit here and find another Republican female out here and we publicly got in a fight, immediately be out on all media, catfight at the CPAC, Republican women gone wild, whatever comments that would be said.
Right.
Not going to happen to the Democratic Party. They would just go unnoticed. It would go
The Democratic Party, by and large, doesn't get covered.
Hell, I think that's the exact opposite.
Democrats are holding press conferences constantly talking about the issues that are important to them. We have a jobs crisis, not a budget crisis, for example. Nobody shows up.
Yeah, but maybe those are embarrassing, boring press conferences that are like, if I put this on air, you guys are going to start losing votes. I mean,
The Democratic Party has to learn how to do better theater.
They have done a much better job of it, just like they've done a much. Ready for me to get you angry? Get your listeners
Try.
Angry. They've done a much better job of figuring out how to buy off votes, and that's with entitlements. The Republicans will never win as long as we're not able to sit there and buy off votes through our welfare system.
You know, Jude Wininsky, I think, nailed it back in 1976 when he said that the Democratic Party has been the party of Santa Claus forever. You know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment benefits, 40-hour work week, vacation time, paid time and a half, workplace safety rules, all this. The Democratic Party has been the party of Santa Claus, and the Republican Party has always been the party of Scrooge. They've always said, they said no to absolutely everything. And he said the Republican Party has to become a party of Santa Claus. We have to find our own Santa Claus. And the Santa Claus that he suggested was tax cuts, which was, in 76, a radical idea. Barry Goldwater was not in favor of tax cuts. He was in favor of raising taxes as part of a package to balance the budget in the election in 1964.
And he's like a human Google. No wonder why you guys listen to him. You're so popular. You are truly a human Google. Keep going. I'm getting a history lesson.
But it's true. I mean, I was 13 years old. I walked door to door with my dad on behalf of Barry Goldwater, so I know what his positions were. But the point is that the Republican Party's their Santa Claus is now tax cuts. The Democratic Party's Santa Claus is all this other stuff. And Barack Obama's coming along and he's saying, I'll shoot my Santa if you shoot your Santa. I don't think it's going to happen, do you?
No, of course not, because it doesn't help us. First of all, the fact that if Republicans do have any sort of Santa Claus, that's not what we need to be doing here, and that's not going to bridge any gap. Whether it be, you know, tax cuts, yes, for the problem with some of the tax cuts, while they say they're tax cuts for the wealthy, it wasn't tax cuts for the wealthy. It was tax cuts, honestly, on the middle class.
No, if you're going to be a real Santa Claus, you got to give tax cuts to everybody.
Exactly. I mean, Santa doesn't pick and choose who he gives tax cuts to, and that's where the success of the Democratic Party is. However, once again, the Republicans are going to have to learn this message. We're going to have to find a way for Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, and the leaders of the Tea Party to sit down at a table and say, okay, guys, what are we going to do?
Right, yeah. And good luck on that, Scotty Nellhues.
I have faith.
Indeed.
I agree that we got along on this radio show.
There you go. And your website, once again, Scotty?
TPNN.com or townhall.com.
There you go. Scotty Nellhues, thank you so much, Scotty. Great talking with you. Nice meeting you. Stick around just a second. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman broadcasting live from CPAC. Back with more right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, in Washington, D.C. And John Horvat II is with me. He's the author of this book, Return to Order, Where We've Been, How We Got Here, and Where We Need to Go, From a Frenzied Economy to an Organic Christian Society. And he's also the Vice President of the American Society for the Defense of Tradition, Family, and Property. ReturnToOrder.org is the website. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Mm-hmm. If I haven't had time to read your entire book, but right. But in your liner notes, in the dust jacket, it says, you know, in this penetrating analysis of contemporary society, you talk about the present crisis and claim that modern economies have become cold, impersonal, out of balance. And here's where I thought it was really interesting. Society has discarded the natural restraining influence of the human institutions and values that should temper our economic activities. And then later on, you go on to talk about how organic Christian order presents a refreshing picture of this order, describes the calming influence of these natural regulating institutions. This reminds me a lot of Thomas Hobbes in Leviathan, and in which he suggested that the natural state of man was to be a savage, and that without the iron fist or restraining influence, he used both phrases, of church or state, that the natural state of man would be without ways of moving things, without society, without art, without letters, and life would be nasty, brutish, and short. Or words to that effect. I'm paraphrasing badly from memory, but you're familiar with it. And in a way, Hobbes with Leviathan in I think it was 1342 or something like that. It was much later. 1642, in the 1640s. Because Locke followed him in the 1670s, he kicked off the Enlightenment. I mean, you know, he kicked off both the modern conservative movement and the modern liberal movement. The liberal movement, in that he said people can govern themselves, which was a radical liberal idea, and the conservative movement, in that he said that people need a restraining institution.
Right.
So, can you tell me your thoughts on that? I mean, this was the big debate between Jefferson and Adams. You know, mm-hmm. Jefferson saw disorder and said, hey, it's a great thing. That's society evolving. Adams saw disorder. Adams was a conservative. Jefferson mm-hmm. was liberal in those mm-hmm. terms. Adams saw disorder and said, this is terrible. We need to pass the Alien Sedition Act and put Ben Franklin's grandson in jail because he's talking. His lips are too loose in his newspaper. I've been ranting here. It's your turn.
Right. No, no. I think you definitely had a point.
Do I have an understanding of your book, in fact?
I would not necessarily go to the point of supporting Hobbes and his Leviathan as a restraining influence. I would say that these institutions like family, community, faith, these are natural institutions that regulate, that calm, that keep markets free and keep them from going out of balance. And these things are not top-down things that come that impose themselves upon a people. They generally come from the people and are something so natural to man. These natural institutions and
institutions like family,
community, faith, morals, all these things are.
I don't disagree with any of them.
Right, exactly. Whereas I think Hobbes would be more the idea of this Leviathan, which is a bit more imposing, you know.
Yeah, well, he was
a lot more imposing.
Yeah, while he was challenging the king or the idea of kingdom. He was also supportive of king and kingdom.
Right.
And he was kind of straddling that conundrum because, you know, in the 1640s, it was like, okay, what do we do? All we've ever had is kings.
Right.
At least from their point of view.
And it was an absolute monarchy, too, which I would certainly be against because these type of organic solutions, they should come from the people. They should come from bottom down and not from top up.
Right, from bottom up rather than top down.
Yeah.
If the natural state of people, of humans, is to form family and clan and tribe and community, and out of that come more sophisticated institutions, church, government.
Right.
Isn't it the natural thing for man to look out for each other? I mean, isn't that wired into us? Isn't that?
Yes, we are social beings, and we need these social bonds, the natural leaderships and social bonds. Return to Order speaks about that. You know, saying these are very essential elements that we've lost, and as a result, it's become very mechanical, very cold, very impersonal.
But the essence of the conservative message that I hear here at CPAC and have for the 6 years I've been coming over and over and over again is be selfish, get yours, that if each person pursues their own selfish interest, to hell with their family and their community and the country, then the best possible outcome will come from that. This is kind of Milton Friedman 101.
Right, the best possible
outcome will come because everybody's self-interest is going to, you know, recalibrate the marketplace. And therefore we don't need the institutions that we ourselves have created that help us out. What am I missing?
No, I think you're correct. I would definitely agree with you that we do need these institutions, that this extreme individualism is, in the final analysis, very harmful, not only to the individual, but also to society in general.
So what are you doing at CPAC?
Well, I mean, there is a wide range of thought here. I mean, you have the libertarians, you have the social conservatives. The social conservatives would certainly be on that side, saying, well, we do need these natural regulating, restraining influences that are so helpful for us, you know.
So
that we don't need government as a result.
Right. Yeah. I read this fascinating book years ago. Ross was the author's name. It was called Dancing with a Ghost, and he was a lawyer for Native Americans up in northern Canada, and it was about how these Aboriginal societies, these tribal societies, very non-Western societies, how they were. They were so not into messing with each other's lives, and yet they were so totally there for each other. Mm-hmm. There were some fairly extreme examples in the book, but where have we gone wrong? What, in your opinion, when did we lose that? Because it seems like that's been part of human society from the very beginning. This idea of clan and tribe and the institutions that come out of it, whether you call them shaman or whether you call them the Catholic Church.
Uh-huh. No, definitely these institutions are very natural institutions. They're based on natural law. I think the modern period is pretty much where we go off. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the book itself, we mention how the Industrial Revolution had a big role in that. I'm not saying I'm against technology or against progress, but the rate of progress and the very frantic pace of these of how society changed, especially in the 19th century, started this process. And today we see even it's gone to a much, much greater
extent. So what's the solution?
The solution is organic Christian society, which I mentioned in the book. It would be a society that is much more, which is treats people like human beings and not machines. That has is rooted in faith, community, and family, mm-hmm. and that has an esteem for natural leaderships and social ties.
Have you ever been or worked in any of the essentially tribal societies of other religions? The Muslim tribal societies, the Hindu tribal societies,
right?
The Buddhist tribal societies, because I have, and uh-huh. and it seems like what you're describing applies to any religion.
Well, I
to
mean,
any society.
Right. I mean, what we're talking about is a framework of principles that are timeless principles that apply to all peoples in all times. And religion does play an important role. But let's face it: if you have an economy that doesn't have values, principles, temperance, it's going to fail.
But don't values, principles, and temperance come out of our essential humanity, and we use that to inform our religions? Rather than, a Bronze Age god writing them on a stone tablet and saying, here? Because they're found in every society
right.
around the world, whether they're monotheistic, polytheistic, pantheistic.
Right. Organic societies have existed from time immemorial, as
right.
you say. And, of course, many of them were primitive, and
values are not that different
from
what you're recommending here.
And what I'm saying is that a Christian organic society gives us a little bit more, let's say, it makes it easier for us to practice, especially the Christian virtues, the cardinal virtues of justice, prudence, temperance, and...
Right.
And
so for somebody who's inclined to be a Christian,
right.
this makes perfect sense. Are you suggesting, as many Christians do, that all of the religions should be done away with and should be replaced by Christianity?
Well, I'm a Catholic, and so I definitely believe in the Catholic Church, and
so you're evangelical.
I hold in high esteem all the values of the Catholic Church. In this particular book, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we need these particular framework of principles, which are applicable to everyone. And I would encourage everyone to take advantage of these principles. But of course, I would say that the Catholic Church is the best expression of that. You know, as it existed, as a lot of those basic framework of principles that the Catholic Church has promoted.
Yeah. What are the changes that you'd like to see in the Catholic Church to bring that about?
Well, in the book, I don't talk about actually the Catholic Church, how mm-hmm. they would bring that about.
Right.
What I say is in society in general, yes. That what I would, why I wrote the book was to say, well, we're in a crisis. Things are happening. We need to look at alternatives. It's not a question of if we can change or if we must change. We are changing to a radical socialist agenda, and we need to look at things on the other side.
Wasn't Jesus a radical socialist?
No, absolutely not.
Everybody owned everything collectively. I mean, that's actually communist.
No, the first disciples as a religious community, of course,
right.
they did. But later
but they were
on,
like a kibbutz. Everybody owned everything that everybody owned. They shared the common purse.
It was sort of like the case of the religious orders that exist in the Catholic Church, the Benedictines, the Franciscans, the Jesuits. They are a religious community who dedicate their whole lives to the church, and as a result, they need the sustenance to
carry. Is that
music
playing? Oh, I'm sorry. We have to take a break, John.
No problem.
I'm sorry. We got to adjust. John Horvat, his book is Return to Order. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio
website?
And video archives.
Yes, returntoorder.org.
Returntoorder.org is the
right.
website for John's book. If you want to
right.
check it out. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and broadcasting live from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. And here with us is Eric Telford, the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives and Outreach with the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity. The website, FranklinCenterHQ, as in headquarters.org. And Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on
Thanks
today.
For joining us. Franklin Center, as in Ben?
Exactly, as in Ben Franklin.
Okay, so what are the values that Ben Franklin had that animate you guys?
Well, particularly what inspires us is his background in newspapers and journalism that helped lead to the American Revolution. So we look today at a declining for-profit media landscape with not enough reporters to inform taxpayers about what's happening with their dollars at state capitals, not enough reporters doing investigative work to expose waste, fraud, and abuse. So we fill that void from a nonprofit perspective on the ground in 32 states.
Wow. And you're focusing on waste, fraud, and abuse in government? Or do you also look at waste, fraud, and abuse in corporations?
We look at waste, fraud, and abuse among all sectors that impact the public. So that includes companies. We've investigated companies, foundations, the government as well.
Yeah, somebody ought to be looking at the health insurance industry. I don't get this. How is it that UnitedHealthcare can have two CEOs in a row who each made over $1 billion? You know, John McGuire made $1 billion, and the guy who followed him, Stephen J. Hemsley, made $1 billion. They got 100 executives making over $1 million a year. And are you guys exposing this?
I'm not familiar with the particulars on that. That does sound like something that would be interested in looking.
And you know where a lot of their money is coming from? Medicare.
Really?
These are the guys who are selling the plans through AARP to fill in the holes that the Republicans drilled in Medicare back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and well, the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, big time. So in any case, I'm guessing that
the thing we found is that there's no shortage of waste, fraud, and abuse in government, public companies, or
anywhere,
or private companies and foundations. So it's good for business for us.
Yeah. Investigate Coke Industries. That would be a good one. Internet privacy. You wanted to talk about internet privacy.
Yes.
What's the issue here?
Well, I think very few of us can say that we've never used Google as a search engine, watched a YouTube video, even used their Gmail email as a service. And there are a lot of privacy implications that I think the public isn't aware of what's being collected, what's being monitored about them. We've recently seen an article in a lot of the postmortems about the election, a story about Target and the data that they collect when consumers make purchases.
Target, like Target, the store?
Like Target, the store, exactly. And how they're able to use predictive modeling to determine buying trends, such as if you buy particular prenatal vitamins and lotions, you're likely pregnant. And there was a case recently where a high school girl got a mailing to her at her home, intercepted by her father advertising cribs and diapers, and father called Target very angry and said, are you trying to encourage my teenage daughter to get pregnant? And store manager apologized, called back a week later to apologize again, and the father said, I'm the one who owes you an apology. I just found out my daughter is pregnant.
They knew
the week before the dad did, based on the purchases she'd been making at the store. And every facet of our lives is being tracked, I think, digitally today, whether it's what we buy at Target, what stops we pass with an easy pass in our car on the roads, what we search on Google, what emails we send and receive. And there are a lot of implications that I think the public should be aware of. Recently, Google's been investigated by the FTC and several state attorneys general with regard to this matter.
Yeah, we saw this writ large. My wife Louise and I, she had breast cancer last year, and so she was Googling all kinds of stuff relating to that. And any computer that she would go to and log on to, what would pop up? Ads for wigs or ads for, cancer cures and things. And it's like, thank God it was just breast cancer. Or, what if she was, like, seriously into porn? And, and now she's logging up, she goes into... this is a serious thing. All you have to do is walk behind somebody who's literally reading the New York Times online, and you immediately know something about them by the nature of the ads that show up.
Yep.
And so what do we do about this?
Well, I think...
Is this a crisis,
mm-hmm.
or is this simply the price people are willing to pay for a free view of free online shopping or whatever in exchange for...
I think the answer is twofold. One is the public needs to be more educated, and that's where groups like Franklin come into play, and many others who are speaking out on this issue. Just, it is the price people pay in certain regards. They've got to be willing to know what they're getting into, and I think too many people are ill-informed and entering into this behavior, not realizing the implications. Secondly, I do think that there are some pending legal cases, particularly in five states where attorneys generals are continuing their investigation and perhaps will continue pursuing legal cases on an antitrust basis against Google for some of their practices. And I think those should be examined, as well as certain issues where emails and other content are turned over to governmental agencies without so much as a warrant.
Right.
And the public doesn't know that they're being searched by a government entity without their consent.
Well, but the fact of the matter is, typically, sometimes they're turned over to government, sometimes government simply buys them.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like, it's, if I want to, people are like, you know, oh my God, you know, how are we going to, you know, what about the gun owners? You know, gun owners, there shouldn't be any registration, right? Shouldn't be no registry at all. We don't, you know, but I can sell you a list right now for, you know, $15, $20, 1,000 names of people who own guns, right? The NRA sells it. I could broker it, I think. I'm pretty sure they allow brokers to resell
it. Oh,
it's
still available in buying consumer data from people's credit card purchasing histories.
Yeah.
You can find out pretty much as much as you want to about anybody.
Yeah.
It's the
digging
through their trash in the digital age.
Yeah, so when I've discussed this with conservatives, and particularly libertarians on this program, I think it's a big deal, and I think that there should be constraints on it. Mm-hmm. And their response has been, you're calling for big government.
Well, and I think here's the issue, because we're up against a struggle, particularly with some of the, not so much on the privacy side, but on some of the search practices of Google that have triggered these, that are triggering trade practice investigations. Mm-hmm. I think the...
It's antitrust issues?
Antitrust, thank you, sorry. I've not had enough coffee today. I mean, generally conservatives, we say we're against antitrust. The problem here is the unequal application of the law. While other entities have had aggressive legal action pursued by the Department of Justice and the FTC and other entities, Google's been let off more or less with a slap on the wrist. At the same time, they're a major donor to the Obama administration and have a number of senior officials who are former Google executives.
Interesting. Eric, thank you very much for being with us. Eric Telford, the website is franklincenterhq.org. Thank you
so much for having me.
Keep up the good work. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm showing fun. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The second hour of our program live from the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC. And Senator Sherrod Brown on the line with us. Senator, I'm assuming you're not here at the zoo.
Yeah, I'm not at CPAC. Are you at CPAC? You were actually, they let you into CPAC.
I am sitting right here on Radio Row with every conservative talk show host on earth. On the left or right of me, yes, sixth year in a row.
What's that?
This is the sixth year in a row that I've.
And they know how scary you are.
I think so. It's you know, I feel like I'm going to the zoo.
They 280 pounds. All of him are there. All of him is there. Are there?
I know. It's amazing. So I'm wondering what's up with you and with the Senate. The sequester, the budgets, the job crisis that we have that everybody keeps insisting is actually a deficit crisis. What are your thoughts on what's going on right now? And in particular, I'm curious what your thoughts are. I saw a headline over at TPM, I think it was today, that said, President to Democratic leaders, do something about that filibuster. It's like, what?
Well, and we do need to. I mean, it's a number of comments and questions there. You start with the context we're in. Until, you know, this lurching from fiscal crisis to fiscal to emergency to from continuing resolution to debt ceiling to fiscal cliff to sequestration to another continuing resolution to another debt limit. I mean, this didn't happen, obviously, until the Tea Party took over, and we've got to stand up to that. And the part of it is, you're right, part of it is this filibuster rule. The president can't get his people in to, whether it's a judgeship, whether it's Rich Cordray, whether it's the NLRB, qualified public officials that should be serving their country now. And it's in this radical anti-government's best interest, these people that don't think government can ever do anything right, to do everything they can to disrupt that. And we've got to stand stronger than we have.
Well, isn't there a certain element of they don't actually believe there isn't anything government can do right, because they do want government to be sure to give tax breaks to rich people and huge, not just tax breaks, but here cash back to the oil companies and And, you know, they want government to regulate trade policy in a way that works to the benefit of multinationals rather than working people. I don't get how they can come off saying they don't like government.
Well, they like plutocracy. I mean, I think it's interesting a couple of things. One is that they say they want balanced budgets. They really want a smaller government, but a government that serves mostly the upper class. And yesterday, Senator Durbin was on the floor with me, and I was speaking about in opposition to repealing the health care law. And Durbin pointed out that the Republicans over and over said we want government involved in health care, yet every single Republican senator is on the government-sponsored health care plan. It's government-sponsored health care. And there is more than a little hypocrisy there that the government serves. A former senator once said here, they used to say that 90% of, I think it's a bit of an exaggeration, but 90% of what goes on here serves the rich and powerful. Mm-hmm. We've got to make sure the other 10% works better and works for the public. And that's, again, a bit of an exaggeration, but some days it's not. And that's why, you know, shows like yours matter so much and making sure we fight for people without opportunity and people with less privilege.
Yeah, well, thank you. What are the top priorities for you right now? What are you working on? We're talking with Senator Sherrod Brown, by the way. SherrodBrown.com is one of your websites, but it's brown.senate.gov, is that right?
Brown.senate.gov, yeah. A couple things. One is we're in the beginning of doing a more expansive trade policy that I'm now on the Finance Committee, and I'm working with colleagues to do some interesting things. I've opposed, as you have, virtually every trade agreement because they always end up causing more jobs to go overseas, causing pulling down wages, doing all the letting in sometimes products that are less than safe. Mm-hmm. And that's how our trade policy has far too often worked. And there's a better way to do it. We don't disengage from the world. We just engage in a different way. More immediately, I've been part of a bipartisan effort that I've been working on for 3 years, coming out of what was called the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, to basically break up the largest six banks in this country. Their economic power and their political power are growing almost every day. 15 years ago, the largest six banks in this country combined to have about 20% of GDP and assets. Today, that number is almost 65% of GDP, their assets. And that clearly doesn't serve this country, that these banks are too big to fail. They're too complicated to understand or manage, and they're too impossible to regulate. And it's clear their size is a big part of that problem.
Hmm. But if the Republicans can prevent Richard Cordray from even becoming, you know, the appointed head of an agency that regulates at least one dimension of banking, how can we get anything done?
Well, we can get things done. I mean, part of it is joining the debate. I mean, it's a discouraging time in that way, but I'm not discouraged because there always are avenues. I mean, on my bank bill, it would basically limit the non-deposit liabilities to 2 or 3% of GDP, so these banks couldn't be this gargantuan and this powerful. There are 10 Republican offices we're working with that are interested in this. There's a couple of Republicans that have been very public in support of this concept, if not specifically yet co-sponsoring. We're working in the next couple of weeks and kind of lining that up for introduction. I think there's a suspicion on both sides. Not as many Republicans as Democrats, but suspicion of both sides, more than skepticism about the size and power of financial institutions, because we know what it can do to our economy. We know how much wealth was lost in this country in 2007, 8, 9, and 10 because of the financial implosion and the fact that government did what it did with Wall Street, but so often at the expense of Main Street.
One of the really interesting divides that I'm finding here at CPAC, and our listeners and viewers have been catching, you know, we've just had a series. You're our first non-CPAC guest.
Right.
So it's like, you know, we're grabbing people off the floor and say, come on, let's talk. Is that there is one strain of Republicans/conservatives who say government shouldn't play any role whatsoever in restraining the size of business because, you know, the marketplace, after all, should be free. And then there's another strain, and we just had a guy on, in fact, in the last hour, who was saying, you know, Google's run amok, and we're unevenly using the Antitrust Act against them. He was using that as an example, but I think it is a broader issue here that you know, there are some conservatives who are saying there is a role for government in restraining corporate overreach. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are that overwhelming number of people in the country. I mean, CPAC is hardly representative of much of a cross section of the country. But I found a number of people who don't vote for me, who are in Ohio, who are conservatives, call themselves conservatives. They are more honest conservative, maybe in the Edmund Burke tradition, but whatever. I mean, it was called a liberal, I think, back then. I always have to be careful with history on the Tom Hartman show. But they really are honest conservatives and have suspicions of big government, but they also have suspicions of the concentration of power in the private sector. And, they don't like socialism, to be sure, because in their view, that's too much power concentrated among government bureaucrats, in their view. But they also don't like power concentrated in a small number of banks or a small number of other powerful media organizations or whoever they might be that wield far too much power over them and over our society and over our economy.
Yeah, remarkable. Senator Sherrod Brown with us. Senator Brown, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Glad always to do it. Thanks, Tom.
Always great talking to you. We'll be back with more from CPAC right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC. Tom Hartman broadcasting live. We'll be right back. Welcome back live from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Tom Hartman here with you. And Terry Jeffrey is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of CNS News, which used to be called the Conservative News Service back in the day when we first started having you guys on. In fact, we were debating the war in Iraq, I think, back then. But now it's just CNS, right?
Right.
CNSnews.com, part of Brent Bozell's Media Research Center, and CNSnews.com, the website. So, Terry, I'm curious your thoughts on just, like, what's the most important thing going on here at CPAC from, you know, as a conservative reporter, from your perspective?
Well, you know, I think maybe the main function of CPAC has always been for conservatives from all around the country to get together and meet one another or see one another again. Most of the people here walking around the hall, sitting in the, listening to the speeches at the dinner tonight and tomorrow and so forth, are people who are involved on a grassroots activist basis around the country in conservative politics. Mm-hmm. So it's really sort of a networking event more than anything else, I think.
Right. So nobody has said anything or broken, made news or, you know, Rand Paul didn't get up and call for the impeachment of John McCain. Or, you know.
Well, it's a good question. I didn't see Rand Paul's speech. I haven't seen a lot of the speeches. I did just see Tim Scott's speech, and I'd never seen him speak before. I think he did an excellent job. I think, Tom, that's another thing that goes on. There are people who are conservative politicians around the country who can use this as a platform to develop a more national base of support, and I think that Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina just took a step in that direction just a minute ago.
Yeah. Interesting. Jeb Bush seems to be changing positions on immigration, shall we say.
Right.
I think it's really interesting to watch these guys position themselves to run for president. They move into the center for a while so that they get the word out, and then during the primary season they become, you know, very much closer to the base, far more hard right, and then after the primaries are over they kind of dump the base, and or at least that's what Romney did. It's what George W. Bush did.
Right.
I don't know that his dad was all that good at it. It's certainly what Reagan did. You think George Bush is going to be the next candidate?
Jeb Bush.
Or Jeb Bush, right?
No, I don't believe so. You know, I did see he's had three different positions on whether or not there should be a quote-unquote pathway to citizenship or amnesty for illegal aliens in the last year.
Right.
I think it would be extremely difficult for Jeb Bush to emerge as a Republican presidential candidate, in part because of his brother and his father. I think his, you know, he would bear the burden of all the mistaken policies that his brother pursued as president over 8 years. And he definitely would be the establishment candidate. He would not be the conservative candidate. I think his viability to a large degree would depend, to the degree there were a field of potentially viable conservative candidates who split up the conservative vote in the early caucuses and primaries and allowed him to emerge, you know, if he got like 28% of the vote and kept getting it. Yeah.
What do you say to the Republicans? And there are some, there's probably not a lot of them here at CPAC, but if this was the RNC, you'd have a lot of them, who are saying, Barry Goldwater, you know, what conservatives like yourself, Terry Jeffers, what you guys are doing by promoting Tea Party candidates, conservative candidates, and candidates who are especially favored by billionaires like the Koch brothers, who are working aggressively for the interests of very large businesses and low taxes for billionaires, to the detriment of things like, you know, Eisenhower famously defending Social Security, in fact, running in 1956 in his platform on the fact that he had expanded Social Security. What do you say to the Republicans who have been historically more middle of the road, even John McCain, who say that you guys are going to fracture the party? In fact, you know, the House of Representatives is controlled by Republicans right now, but Democrats got 1.5 million more votes in the last election for the House. If it hadn't been for gerrymandering, we'd have a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic president. There are people in the Republican Party who say that's your fault.
Right. Well, you know, the last two Republican presidential candidates, John McCain and Mitt Romney, have not been conservatives. Romney made this incredible transition from being basically a liberal Republican governor in Massachusetts to being a very conservative candidate for the Republican nomination. I did not believe he was credible. Interesting thing, Tom, I remember, I forget which one of the major television networks did an interview with Romney where he said maintaining the progressive income tax was a matter of principle with him.
Mm-hmm.
And when he said that, I wanted to do a little research. What did Ronald Reagan say about the progressive income tax? And I found a reference in a scholarly journal, believe it or not, about a quote that Reagan had made when he was an actor in 1960 to the Orange County Press Club. And the speech was actually reprinted in Vital Speeches of the Day. It was a speech given July 26, 1961, at the Orange County Press Club. The University of Michigan Library had that speech in its archives. I found a guy up there. He sent me a PDF. Read the speech, wrote a column about it. I would suggest if
This was not when Reagan was still a Democrat. He had become a Republican by then.
Right? He certainly had become a conservative. I believe he had become a Republican. But he was just an actor. He was not a political figure. This was before he gave his
speech. Well, he was, you know, as soon as he married Nancy Davis, her dad wired him into the Republican political machine, got him a job with GE, got him on the fast track to big bucks and big politics, and he started talking about politics.
He certainly was talking about politics, whether he's, you know, privately...
So anyhow, what did he say?
1961, encroaching control was the speech, but in that speech he said that the progressive income tax came straight from Karl Marx, which is in fact true. It did.
You can find Thomas Jefferson writing about the progressive
well, they didn't allow a federal income tax, a broad-based federal income tax in the U.S. Constitution.
But he talked about, you know, that actually he suggested that when wealth becomes great enough to subordinate the interests of the state, it should be diminished by taxation that increases in a geometric nature. I'm pretty sure that's close to a verbatim quote.
He also owned many slaves who he never even freed. He died tremendously.
I'm not here to defend Jefferson's slavery.
Quite frankly, I don't think Thomas Jefferson was a role model in Europe.
What I'm saying is,
to tell you the truth,
you know, progressive taxation is not something that originated with
Karl Marx.
But
it was not part of what America believed in, or was even constitutional. And in fact, you know, individual income tax was not constitutional until the 20th century. But the thing is, what I'm saying is, in this particular speech, which people can read, it's part of the public record, Ronald Reagan explained what he believed was going to happen in America if we continued on this sort of progressive liberal path. I think he predicted it quite well, but he was a person at the dawn of his political career believed in very limited government and traditional values in a way where these establishment Republicans today would describe as being non-viable. Yet he is, in fact, the person who invented the modern conservative movement as a political figure.
Yeah, amazing. Terry Jeffries, CNSnews.com is the website. Terrence Jeffries. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC. And sitting right across from me, my old friend and debating partner, Peter Ferrara. Hey, Peter.
As I always say, glad to be here. I'm not sure about that right now, but that's my signature line.
It's very nice to have you in person. Peter works with the Heartland Institute. Heartland.org is the website. He's the director of entitlement budget policy. And you're working on win-win entitlement reform. Whenever I hear entitlement reform coming out of the mouths of conservatives, like yourself, no offense. In fact, I think you're probably quite proud of it. It usually, when you drill down into it, means poor people are going to get less.
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to counter. That's what I mean by win-win entitlement reform.
Okay.
Our entitlement programs are so old, outdated, poorly constructed, that you can, in fact, reform them by proven reforms that have already shown that they can work in the real world to actually provide better benefits and income for the poor and for seniors while saving taxpayers 50% or more.
Does this involve handing them off to the banks?
No, not. I don't know how you hand off somebody to banks. But
well, you privatize them. I mean, you know, it's like Paul Ryan. He wants to voucherize Medicare. He wants to turn it over to the health insurance companies. Is that the sort of reform you're talking about, or are you talking about actually changing the government programs but keeping the government as the group that writes the checks?
Well, it won't really. It's not the best for the poor if the government's the group writing the checks. But we, for example,
so the banks would be better.
Banks would be better. No, I'm not. Actually, banks have
would be better.
Well, that depends on what reform you're talking about. But I'll use, for example, the 1996 welfare reform, where they block granted the one old New Deal welfare program, the old Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, AFDC, back to the states.
Right.
And they said to the states, you now have authority. We've sent this. We're going to send the federal funding back to you in a fixed, finite block grant. Previously, federal funding was provided in a way that called matching, under a matching formula. The more the state spent, the more the federal government would send to the state.
Right.
And that was effectively paying the states to spend more, which they were glad to do as long as the federal government was paying them to do it. So
they had to do it within certain guidelines. I mean, they had to demonstrate that they actually had poor people. I mean, there was a reason why Mississippi was getting more of that money than was, you know, a wealthier, smaller state like Rhode Island.
Well, they had to sign up more poor people for welfare to get the money, but they were glad to do that as long as the federal government was paying them to do that. But what's wrong with that? Well, it gives you the incentive
to spend
more than is necessary. So what they did with the reform is they said, okay, now you're going to get a fixed finite amount from the federal government. If you spend more, that's got to come 100% out of your pocket. But if you get people out to work and you spend less, then you can keep the savings.
Sure, but if there's no work?
What happened was that transformed the incentives, and within a couple of years, two-thirds of the people on that program nationwide actually went to work.
Yeah, well, that's because we had 3% unemployment. We had we were in the middle of an economic bubble, but when the bubble burst, those people, there was no safety net to catch them because AFDC had been destroyed.
I'm going to show you, I'm going to surprise you in a minute and show you an area agreement, but let me finish what they did in 96 first.
Okay.
And they, so in 96, they changed the reform incentives for the state bureaucrats administering the programs. The states went from he ain't heavy, he's my brother, to you guys got to get out and go to work. And so, actually, even though the liberals said these people can't work, they can't support themselves, within a couple of years, two-thirds of the people who were dependent on that program left the program and actually went to work. Their incomes were documented to increase by 25%. Poverty dropped precipitously, particularly poverty among black children. These are documented results. I'll give you one book, Work Over Welfare, by Ron Haskins at the Brookings Institution. Documented these results.
But Peter, you can't ignore the fact that we were in the middle of a bubble. All that stuff went in the opposite direction in 2008, 2009, 2010, when we went into a depression, basically.
That was, I've written extensively about that. That was, of course, caused by the government, caused by the Federal Reserve.
Well, whoever causes it, the point is,
Clinton's
reform of welfare set up a disaster for people when the business cycle crashed.
When you crash the economy, that's going to hurt everybody. But, you know, as I discuss in my book where I'm discussing this reform, here's my idea for win-win welfare. Expand that successful program to all the federal means-tested welfare programs. There's another 200 federal means-tested welfare programs. We're going to spend $10 trillion on those programs over the next 10 years. Block grant it back to the states. And what should the states do? The states then have that money, and they have the authority, completely new welfare system. So here's my new welfare system for you, Tom. You, in fact, are in agreement with this. I would have a welfare system that would eliminate poverty categorically with a guaranteed offer of work. Under the current federal minimum wage, That plus the earned income tax credit, plus the child tax credit, if you work full-time, year-round, you will every family will be out of poverty. They will earn enough to get out of poverty. And so the state government, I recommend, should say to them, you come to this welfare office before 9 in the morning, and we guarantee you 8 hours of work at the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
We guarantee you.
So you're saying the government should be the employer of last resort?
Yeah, under this proposal, if they can't find, they will try to operate like these temp agencies and give you an assignment.
Sure.
To work for the day.
I'm a big fan of the government as employer of last resort. That was the cornerstone of the New Deal.
Well, you in fact, indicated
once before.
You've
become a liberal here, Peter.
You've indicated once before that you support this. Now, see, that transforms the incentives because there's no more disincentive to work from welfare, because
you're right.
You have to work.
Franklin Roosevelt said the best welfare program in the world is a job.
So if you did a program like that, what I think would happen is that millions of people who are now dependent on the government would go to work just like they did in 1996.
Okay, but you do want to keep something in place for people who can't work.
I don't believe in human suffering. So there should be a safety net under all circumstances to prevent people from starvation, from a lack of housing, from suffering due to lack of medical care. And if you do the incentives right, so you don't create unnecessary dependency, it won't cost much. In our rich society, it doesn't cost much to help people in need, as long as you're not creating need by paying people to be poor, which is what the old system did.
This is surprisingly rational, Peter. I don't mean surprisingly, like, from you, but it's quite rational.
So I believe in safety nets for everybody where they are
so
truly in need. But don't create need and then burden the taxpayers.
Yeah. The one area where I think I might dispute your suggestion is that you're saying that you think that state bureaucrats are better and less corruptible than federal bureaucrats. Block grants to the states rather than federal programs.
Well, the thing is that we changed their incentives with the way we structured the block grants. And so that's the key to the future.
No,
people,
but still,
you're going to
turn it over to state bureaucrats instead of federal bureaucrats.
And, yes, because they can. Because
my experience has been the state bureaucrats are more corruptible than federal bureaucrats.
Well, you know,
they certainly have a lot less scrutiny.
Well, the same people vote for state officials that vote for federal officials. So if you think they can handle the responsibility of voting for President of the United States, then they can handle the responsibility of voting for their governor. If you think they can handle the responsibility of voting for U.S. senators and congressmen, they can handle the responsibility of voting for state legislators. So,
yeah. There's some states in this country that are notoriously corrupt. I mean, it's just...
Well, you know, I don't see a lot of corruption on the welfare side of things.
Yeah.
But you do have corruption at the federal level. You have programs that the feds administer that have huge amounts of documented waste, fraud, abuse. And
sure. We have 3 minutes before we got to take a break. So yeah. you had said before, when we were talking off the air, you had said that I made the same mistake that Karl Marx did in saying that capital is not productive.
Yeah, you seem to think that capital makes no contribution to production.
Let me make it very clear. Okay. I think that capital does make a contribution to productivity. And capital plays an important role in our society. My point is that somebody who earns their living with capital should pay the same income tax rate as somebody who earns their living with labor, with
work.
I
agree with that 100%. They should be the same tax rate. They shouldn't be taxed three or four times. And capital
in our
country.
So what I'm saying is do away with the capital gains loophole and have capital gains taxed. So Paris Hilton, sitting on her butt around the pool, earning her living with capital, is paying the same tax rate that you or I are. We're earning our living with our minds or our bodies.
Capital gains tax is a double tax. So to have the same taxes on labor, capital gains tax should be zero.
Well, labor tax is a triple tax.
Capital gains tax is on top of the corporate income tax. It's on top of the individual income tax. It's on top of the death tax. And I don't believe multiple taxation of labor income either. So you can have a general reduction in taxation across the board.
I mean, if you want to use that argument, every dollar...
It's a standard argument.
Every
dollar... I didn't make it up myself.
No, I know, and it's a standard nonsense.
Multiple taxation of capital.
Every dollar that comes into my program that I use to pay my employees, every single dollar of that came from a company that had paid taxes on it. So it's already been taxed. So I shouldn't have to pay taxes, right?
No, no. See, the thing is that a capital is... What is the capital value of an asset? It's the present value of the future, discounted value of the future income stream. That income stream is going to be taxed when it's earned. So if you tax the capital value, you're taxing that future income, same income stream, twice. You see, when you're talking about what comes into your company, that's a new income stream to you. And so that should be taxed once. But with the capital gain inherently taxes the same income stream.
No,
twice.
The capital gain. If I go out and I buy a bunch of Marriott stock and I'm sitting around on my butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you know, I didn't pay taxes on that money that I used to buy that
yes,
Marriott
you did.
Stock.
Yes, it's the corporate income.
I mean, I did pay taxes on that money. I bought it with after tax money, but it's the same thing as if, you know,
the capital gain arises because people think that the future income stream to that capital is going to increase. That income stream is going to be taxed when it's earned. So you may not have heard of the tax on dividends, but in addition to the capital gains, they pay tax on dividends, and the corporation pays another tax on that same income stream. So the same income stream is taxed three times.
And the corporation is paying on the income stream that it's using to pay salaries as well.
It's paying on the yes, it is. It's paying three times on the income stream to the corporation because capital is.
So it's a nonsense argument.
No, it's multiple taxation of capital, and it's working people that lose because if they don't have a capital investment, jobs are not created. They don't have the tools to be more productive, and wages don't go up as fast. They actually can decline rather than rise.
So you disagree with Ronald Reagan. Reagan made capital gains and regular ordinary income exactly the same, 28%.
Reagan agrees with me. That's why he hired me to work at the White House.
Okay, Peter Ferrara. Where to go?
Entitlement, Director of Entitlement, Budget Policy,
at the Heartland Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
Heartland.org. Peter Ferrara, the Director of Entitlement and Budget Policy at the Heartland Institute. Thank you, Peter.
All right, thank you.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from CPAC. Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C. It's a day at the zoo, don't you know? We're having a fine time. We're having an absolutely fine time. Bob in Haynesville, Virginia. Hey, Bob, thanks for calling. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Listen, I heard Tuesday that you had all of these pigs in China floating down the Shanghai River dead. Yeah, Tuesday it was 2,800. I checked the internet today, and it's 5,916. And they're saying that it's not polluting the water. But when you have that many animals, and they don't know what killed them or how they were placed in there, this is a total disaster for those people.
Yeah.
That's the water.
I don't disagree, but, you know, why are we talking about it? I don't know what we can do about it, and what's your point?
It's just that you don't wait until a pandemic breaks out.
You're concerned that the pigs might be dying of something that could infect humans?
Oh, of course. During the Civil War, more people died from dysentery and cholera than bullets.
Yeah, well, I think that was probably true of World War I as well.
But when you have animals that are decomposing in the water like that, and they're not saying how they got there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tough one. Bob, we'll have to wait and find out what the Chinese have to say about this. Jim in Columbus,
Hi.
Ohio. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I have been thinking about the show on PBS, Oliver Stone's series on history,
mm-hmm.
and there's a basic underlying process that I think should really be part of every senior citizen's job in terms of being, you know, a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
As Oliver Stone pointed out, many things he revived facts that had been lost or forgotten or intentionally ignored, the fact that we gave Saddam Hussein biological weapons.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the Hussein administration contacted the State Department and more or less said, and I heard this one myself on PBS, you don't mind if we take back that disputed land between Kuwait
right.
and Iran?
That was a conversation he had with April Gillespie, who worked for the State Department.
Nobody
at the time.
Said anything. So I have one from 1979-1980. That I think is an important fact to bring up. At that time, you know, it was just after the Iranian Revolution took place, and there was a Washington think tank that on a Friday night, I can't remember the specific program, it could be Bill Buckley, could be the McLaughlin Group, talked about how they predicted the fall of the Shah of Iran.
Sure.
And basically they had a scale that ran from 1 to 100 in terms of, you know, lowest on the economic scale, highest on the economic scale.
Mm-hmm.
And once it went past there, they said, you can expect there to be a revolution. Well, obviously some things have changed in our country since then, but we're at 400-1. Of course, we have iPods and, you know, all these other little gigas to play with, which probably account for the higher number.
Yeah.
But I think it's important for all seniors, I think it's important for all citizens to remember the missing facts and bring them to, you know, to the attention of the public like Oliver Stone did.
Totally agree with you, Jim. Thank you for the call, and, you know, well said. No mistaking that. Tom, in St. Louis, Missouri, you want to talk about taxation, Tom?
I do. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just curious what your opinion is on having an asset tax instead of having income tax or having capital gains taxes, including taxing the assets offshore.
Your phone was breaking up. Having a what kind of tax?
Asset tax.
An asset tax. Oh, taxing wealth, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was one of the things that, you know, in the early days when Jefferson translated, when he was president, he secretly, in collaboration with Lafayette, you know, he translated Desuet de Tracy's book on economics, and it got Jefferson thinking about this kind of stuff. He wrote about it extensively in his diary. And Desuet de Tracy was suggesting that there are basically four taxes. I don't have a sneeze button here at CPAC. There is a tax on income, there's a tax on property, there's a tax on transactions, which we call sales tax, and then there's a tax on wealth. And we've never adopted a wealth tax in the United States, to the best of my knowledge. Many European countries have them. And I think a tax on wealth, the only extent to which we have a tax on wealth, arguably, is the estate tax. But even that's really not a tax on wealth. That's a tax on the transaction.
Or the local property taxes.
Right. Well,
it's
a transaction tax. It's the transaction of transferring assets or wealth from a person who has just died to a person who's still alive.
Right.
So I'm with you. I think that a wealth tax makes a lot of sense, and I think that over $1 billion worth of wealth, the wealth tax should be at 100%. And we started a campaign called No More Billionaires. That billionaires were, you know, they had. When somebody's wealth reaches $1 billion, personal wealth, not necessarily their corporate assets or whatever, that it has reached the point where it arguably has the potential to be destructive to democracy. And so if you're going to have a wealth tax everything over $1 billion, and who can't make it on $999,999,999?
Totally agree. But companies are not in the business of administering taxes or even administering health insurance, and they're in the business of doing their business,
right, of making
so
money.
I can see the logic in wanting to reduce the income tax or wanting to have it managed differently, I could say the same thing about health insurance and healthcare.
Right.
You know,
right.
Companies administering that is just another burden. I'm sympathetic,
sure,
to that point of view,
sure,
but there's just so much money not being taxed offshore that is, you know, through loopholes and everything else, evading taxes.
I'm with you, Tom. I think that, you know, a conversation of a wealth tax, thanks for the call, a conversation of a wealth tax would be a fascinating one to have in this country. I have a feeling that neither party will go near it, but I think it's a conversation that we should have. We'll be back with more from the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, just outside of Washington, D.C. this year. Usually it's downtown, but this year it's way down on the river out in the state of Maryland. And in fact, this hour, Richard Fowler is going to be filling in for me the last half hour because I got a TV appointment tonight. So, we're having a great time. And Tim Young is with us. He's the managing editor of Absolute Rights.
Absolute Rights.
The website, absoluterights.com. What's an absolute right?
It's the rights that you're born with, the ability to be free in the world.
Well, when you're born, if your mom just set you down on the concrete and walked away, you wouldn't last very long. So you have a right to be fed.
You have a right to be fed, yes.
Okay. And you have a right to be clothed.
Yes.
Okay. And housed.
And then later on, you have those rights to, you know, freedom of speech.
And then later on, those rights get taken away, right?
Yeah. Well, they could be.
Well, isn't that what you're suggesting? I mean, if you're suggesting that the right that you're born with is the right to food and clothing and housing, I mean, that's what Franklin Roosevelt said in his Second Bill of Rights should actually be rights. And what I usually hear from conservatives and libertarians is, no, once you're of the age of majority, 16, 17, 18, depends on the society, screw that. Those rights are just for kids, and you're on your own, Charlie.
No, I think everybody has a right to be able to be fed and be given just enough to make it on their own and kind of be brought up. I'm more.
So
of
you
a,
believe in a welfare state?
I do not believe in a welfare state. I believe in a state where there's more of a hand up than a handout. Like an opportunity should be available to people.
So if everybody has a minimum right for food, how do you make sure everybody has a minimum availability of food?
All right, you might win this one, Tom.
I'm trying to understand your epistemology
Let me tell you. I don't like the concept of handouts from the government, but I do like the idea.
I get that.
And I do like the idea of having programs in place that kind of help people get to where they need to be.
And particularly and people who have no ability to get there. I mean, there are people who are born incapable of working, incapable of talking, incapable of thinking, and you know.
And for those elderly folks too, who no longer are able-bodied, there needs to be something there to help them out. And so that's where maybe I differ with some Republicans when it comes to like Social Security and things like that, and Medicare, Medicaid. I think that there needs to be a standard for people.
So you consider those programs to fall within the concept of absolute rights?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. And you're not, unlike we had a guest a little bit ago who was saying, well, you know. Government does everything inefficiently. Corporations do everything efficiently. Medicare and Medicaid should be administered by the banks and the health insurance companies.
No, you know what? I actually sold technology to the government for a while, the federal government. What I learned is the federal government likes to give money out and then go, oh, we shouldn't have given you that money. Let's go back and get it. Or they give it out to fraudsters a lot of times. There are billions and billions of dollars every year that go out to folks that are running, you know, fake clinics, things like that. And the government really doesn't do those forward checks to take a look at things.
Especially the Pentagon.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the Pentagon is missing $2 trillion.
Yeah.
You're not going to hear any debate from me on that. Although the transparent products, the transparent purchasing that the government does, there are conservative bloggers and reporters and investigators crawling over the butts of every single government bureaucrat and every single program. You find, you know, one program. Oh my God! Look at that. There's waste there in the Department of Agriculture.
There's so much waste everywhere. And the thing that there was a couple of years ago, and I can speak freely more about this now that I'm not in this sales position and I'm doing the political thing. I spoke with both the McCain camp and the Obama camp when they were running for president. The Obama camp was more concerned with what we had to say about recovering the money that was being given out. The McCain camp blew it off.
Yeah,
which blew my mind.
Because they wanted to use that money for social good.
Yeah.
I mean, they actually had an intelligent use for the money, and the conservatives, their only use for the money is give it back to the billionaires.
Well, that, and it made the Republicans look bad at that point, that all this money had seeped out under their administration, under the W's administration, through Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, you know, I've run businesses over the years where I was selling to the government. We used to sell services. We had an ad agency. We did communication seminars and trainings and things. Our clients included the NSA, the CIA, the U.S. Department of the Army Intelligence. Used to do workshops for them in Europe a lot. And also major Fortune 500 companies. And I could go through a list of them, except that they're private corporations and litigious. And frankly, we had to do better due diligence with our government contracts than we did with our corporate contracts, generally speaking. And I remember sitting with the vice president of marketing of one of the largest hotel chains in the world who told me bluntly, he thought it was funny, that he would never hire somebody to work for him. He would rather contract the work out. He would never hire somebody to work for him within the company who was smarter than he was or better than he was because he knew that that would put his job at risk.
Wow.
And it's like that, you know, that mentality in corporate America, there's waste, fraud, and abuse everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
But let's get back to this issue of absolute rights. You before when we were talking, before we went on the air, you said you were thinking about doing something where you were going to try and get in the room, the RINOs, the Republicans in name only. And I'm not sure, can you give me the name of, for example, of a senator who you think falls in that category for demonstration purposes so everybody knows what you're talking about?
Honestly, right now, I don't know that there are any that really fall into that because everybody's
Olympia
trying
Snow?
To... Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, that would be one.
Susan Collins. Susan Collins is still in office.
I mean... Right now, folks are so afraid of the Tea Party, it seems like, and the conservative movement. And when you have people stand up like what Rand Paul did last week, which, although, I mean...
Was John McCain condemned? So does that make him a RINO?
I think that no Republican really wants to work with him at this point. It just seems like he's been, like, kind of
blasted. Wants to work with John McCain?
Yeah, it just seems like he's that, like...
He's that old guy who's yelling, get off my lawn.
Yeah, yeah. they're kind of hoping
that
he's...
kind of tragic,
really. And it really... Because, I mean, he didn't have terrible ideas the entire time that he was there, but, you know, now he's just kind of...
Yeah.
Get off my lawn!
Yeah, that's where he is.
Whippersnappers.
But you want to get the RINOs and the Tea Partiers together. You know...
And the idea is that we keep it away from politics and talk about
policy. Some misguided matchmaking impulse. I mean, your mother wanted you to be a Yentl when you grew up?
I didn't want Obama to win. But I took a look at the Republican candidates that were out there in that primary, and they were a joke. I mean, they were all a joke. I mean, and even when it got to Romney, there was nothing to get behind.
Well, I think some of them were even, like, the Republicans let them in, the Herman Cains and the Michelle Bachmans, because they were intentionally a joke.
Yes.
They knew that there was no chance whatsoever, so it increased the probability that the guy that they really wanted to be the candidate, who was Romney, would win.
That could be. You thin out the pack by... watering it down or whatever.
Well,
it
was Nixon's strategy. He did not want to run against Edmund Muskie, you know. So he sends Chuck Colson or whoever up to Maine, puts some acid in the guy's coffee, and next thing you know, Muskie's up on the back of a truck blubbering and talking about his wife and crying, and that's the end of that. He gets to run against George McGovern.
Who was the threat to Romney, though? Was there a threat? I mean,
I think it was probably too early for Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
And that really speaks to the weakness of the Republican
brand,
I think.
It was just a terrible crop of candidates, and I had written an ebook that did quite well. It was number one on in Political Humor on Amazon, 50 Shades of Romney, Here's a Hint, They're All White. And I talked about how terrible of a candidate he was from top to bottom, flip-flopping on everything, but how terrible everyone else was with him. So there really wasn't a choice for the Republican Party.
So, and frankly, as somebody who's more inclined toward the Democratic or Green Party, I want a healthy Republican Party. I'd like my dad's Republican Party back.
Yeah.
The Eisenhower Party. So you think that's possible? I think that they've been just bought out by the billionaires.
I think it is if you bring in thought leaders and actually start to kind of talk just about policy, keep away from these politicians.
But how do you deal with the whole Citizens United thing that says that the Koch brothers can buy the party? And you know, Koch or Charles Koch ran for president of the United States in the 80s on a Libertarian ticket.
Call me altruistic, but I like to believe that people in the end will come forward and unite under policy and not be bought out.
Really?
Yes.
Well, you know, I think you're seeing some of that in the Democratic Party with people like Sherrod Brown, independents like Bernie Sanders. I mean, these guys, they stand on their principles, damn it. And you know.
And that's what the Republicans need.
Yeah. Okay. I'm with you. Very interesting conversation. Tim Young, Managing Editor, Absolute Rights, AbsoluteRights.com. Thanks, Tim.
Did I get you to agree with me?
I think so. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, Tim Young, AbsoluteRights.com. We'll be back with more from CPAC right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live at the CPAC Conference, the Conservative Political Action Conference, where we are, swimming among the sharks? I don't know what the phrase is. Dan Bongino is with us. Dan is a regular on our TV program. You haven't been on our radio program before, have you?
First time.
Okay, you ran for the United States Senate last year
Maryland.
Virginia? Maryland, here in the state of Maryland, which is where we're located right now. Right. Former Secret Service agent.
Yes, sir.
And do you have a website that you...
Bongino, BONGINO.com.
Bongino.com.
Great. It used to be Bongiorno. My grandparents thought it sounded too Italian, so they changed to Bongino. Good job. Right? No one would ever know.
who would think?
Right.
So, you know, as a conservative here at CPAC, what are you hearing that you like? What are you hearing that you don't like? What's the gestalt here? Give our listeners and our viewers a sense of what's going on.
Well, You know, I think after taking a beating in this election, I don't think we as Republicans should cover that. I mean, we took a beating, the Senate level, the congressional level, where we lost seats. The only place we're really doing well right now is on the governorships. You would expect a little bit more of a morose environment. I don't sense that here. I've never really sensed that at CPAC, but this year I sense it. This may come out wrong, but maybe we've hit the bottom. Mm. And, we need to start marketing the message differently. You know, I mean, we let Barack Obama steal our message, you know, responsible government spending, you know, patient-driven health care. These are things he ran on, and we let him take that message. Now, we have to market it differently, and I think you're going to see a return to that positive smile on your face. Tomorrow will be better conservatism after this.
Would you identify yourself on the spectrum from Eisenhower Republicans at the far left of the Republican spectrum? Sure. Eisenhower arguing that we need strong labor, we need Social Security, to the extreme Tea Party, Ted Cruz Republicans, blow up the government, turn Social Security over to Wall Street. Well, I don't think he said blow it up, but you know what I mean. I mean, shrink it down to the Grover Norquist. Grover Norquist actually said shrink government down to the size where you can drown it in the bathtub. Privatize Social Security, give it to the banks, give Medicare to the health insurance company. Where are you on that spectrum, Dan? How would you define yourself?
I'm a libertarian conservative. You know, I've been on your show, and I think I've surprised you with a few things we happen, you know, to agree on. You played a segment once on, you know, the drug war. Well, yeah. This is a war. we're taking casualties every day by the thousands. That's a situation, me as being a libertarian, where if we're going to look at it with common sense, then we really have to start doing that and reevaluating. So, the drone situation certainly bothered me. I thought Rand Paul asked a very accurate question. You know, he gave the proviso, hey, if they're not engaged in an active war on United States soil, can you drop a Hellfire missile in the local Starbucks? And the Attorney General of the United States had to hesitate on that? I mean,
right. Folks,
libertarian, conservative, I don't really care where you are. Hey, that's a pretty disturbing question.
I did a daily take on the TV show about that, and we did a rant on the radio about that, and that, you know, I thought Rand Paul was right on that question. He was grandstanding, and there was a bit of a stunt in there. And what I find really tragic, frankly, is that the Attorney General then clarified by saying, basically, I'm saying the same thing I said before. And now Rand Paul is saying he agrees with the Attorney General. I mean, you know, he's come out and said that. So he's no longer asking that question, which seems to me kind of weird.
Well, I've met Rand Paul, and I can tell you, I really don't think he was grandstanding. I have to disagree with you on that. I think Rand Paul is...
Let me rephrase it. He was making use of a PR opportunity and brilliantly doing so.
Yeah,
but
and
the fact of the matter is, nobody has to stand on the floor of the Senate to filibuster. That was...
No, you don't have to, but, it, you know, politics is a bit of theater. You know, what do they say?
Sure.
Politics is Hollywood for ugly people.
I've
heard
DC
that quite a bit.
Yeah,
I might fit that mold pretty well. So he needed it. He needed that opportunity to highlight what I think you and I agree. I make that point, though, to tell you that I don't really fit in a box that well. Mm-hmm. I think on immigration, there are a lot of conservatives that don't like my policies, and frankly, there's a lot of liberals' policies that I stand for. You know, we have 12 million people who are here, living, breathing human beings, different than you or me. My wife is a first-generation immigrant. You know, I'm the only person who ran for the U.S. Senate in 2012 that actually deported someone. Are you going to deport 12 million people? The answer is no. It's not possible. You're arguing about a utopia that doesn't exist. Right. These are human beings. These are living, breathing people who are going to contribute to both the intellectual capital and the economic capital of the United States. I've had some people on the left saying I'm too hard because I believe in a border fence. Not to keep people out, but to when you put a wall up on your house and a door, you just want people to come through the door. You don't want them climbing the windows. It's just a way to control traffic. I mean, we have to have some border security. It's a different world. It's unfortunate, but it's true.
Well, we can have that debate. I frankly think that if you were to start putting employers in jail, then you would see a whole lot fewer people trying to come into the country illegally.
I've supported E-Verify for a long time.
Yeah, because the fact of the matter is that the most illegal immigrants didn't cross the Mexican border. They came in as tourists.
Well, then the visas and the visa overstays. It's a problem. But I'd say where we, you know, disagree on that spectrum, and where me and you've gone at it on your show in the air quite a bit, is, you know, on economics. You obviously have a strong Keynesian big government bent, but I believe very strongly in Milton Friedman's statement that, you know, there are four ways to spend money. You can spend it on yourself. You can spend money on other people. Other people can spend other people's money on themselves. And the fourth way, other people can spend other people's money on other people. Well, that's government. When you do that, the fourth way, no matter what happens, Tom,
the cost or the quality of the item don't matter. It's not your money. So the cost doesn't matter, and you're not buying it for yourself, so the quality doesn't matter either. That's just human psychology.
It's our money, Dean.
No, it's not our money.
It is
yours.
No.
There's no such thing as collective money.
You earned it. There is.
No, there's not.
Once government collects it as taxes, it's our money.
No, it's not ours. It's yours.
Are they our roads out there?
No.
Or is it my road?
No, it's not our road.
Is that my road out in front of this hotel, or is it your road?
But you're changing the argument.
No. That road was built with tax dollars.
Right.
Was it our tax dollars that built that road?
No, they were your tax dollars. There's a difference. There's no collective
money. So I can go out and claim part of that road and say, this is my part of the road.
It's a private road, you could.
But it's not. It's a public road.
It doesn't have to be.
But my argument is that once something becomes public, it becomes our. This is what splits libertarians from everybody else.
Have you heard of the tragedy of the commons?
Yeah.
Nobody owns it.
No. The tragedy of the commons was what happens when the commons isn't appropriate to the size of the population.
Tom, when everybody owns something, nobody owns it. That's what happens. That's why it falls apart.
Okay. Well, Dan, we're it's always great having these conversations. Dan Bongino. Bongino.com. Okay, great. Dan, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Appreciate it.
We'll be back with more from CPAC right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more from the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, right after this.
And we are back here at the CPAC 2013 convention. I'm Richard Fowler. Obviously, I'm not Tom Hartman. We were separated at birth, but he had to step away, so I'm filling in for the last half an hour for him on the Tom Hartman radio program. Now, first thing to do is, you know, as always, you can always follow Tom on Twitter, but also follow me on Twitter at Richard A. Fowler, and you will be having the conversation there as well as a conversation with your chat and your calls. Let's take one call. We have Dave calling from Free Speech TV. Dave, how are you?
You there?
Dave, how are you?
I'm fine.
How are you doing today? Well, so you want to talk about, the $1 million, the bank interest? None of. Tell me, what are your thoughts about this whole CPAC convention, the whole show today?
Well, I'm just saying, $1 million in any community bank, the interest per month alone will give someone a middle class, basically a middle class, living. So what I'm saying is people that have millions in the bank should pay a tax for every million, to put a buffer so everybody that lives on minimum wage can at least make a middle class living. Now, I'm not saying that, that you're going to get rich off this, but, if you, like a waitress that makes $2 an hour should at least have something, to come out from this buffer tax so she can pay her bills and, pay for her apartment and, whatever.
Dave, I agree with you here. I think you're completely right. I think, we need to make sure that all Americans have a middle-class wage. I don't think the folks at CPAC agree with that. But we here at the Tom Hartman Program agree that we should have a living wage for all Americans. And hopefully we'll see some movement from the United States Congress on that. Not only, investing in community banks, but beyond investing in community banks, the whole idea of having our minimum wage sort of pegged to inflation so that we aren't, that we don't have poor people in this country. Being that we're of the land of rich and plenty, and millionaires and billionaires can take their corporate yachts and corporate jets anywhere and enjoy those tax cuts, those tax credits for those corporate yachts and corporate jets. I think it's definitely time that we here in America have those same, the middle class and working class families have those same rights afforded to them. Sadly, I don't think that's the case here at the CPAC conference. But either way, and as I was walking in here, coming in to fill in for Tom, I got handed a handy dandy flyer talking about return to order, about, the organic Christian society. I tell you, when you walk into this thing, I felt as though it was like a time warp. Very, very interesting people, very, very interesting flyers like this one that I got here. I can't tell. I mean, I've been to a lot of events, but there's nothing quite like the CPAC convention. Let's take another call. Let's talk to Nancy Bush. And she's talking about capital gains tax compared to the income rate of workers. Nancy, how are you?
Hi, fine. I'm in Michigan, and I just wanted to make another point about the high taxes that the young people pay or the workers pay, and versus the low rate for capital gains. Now, it used to be that capital gains was such a risky business, and therefore an incentive would be a low tax on their return. However, I want to point out that getting an education these days is an extremely high risky endeavor. It's very costly. It takes a lot of time. There's a substantial opportunity cost, and there's much less guarantee at the end of the degree that that person is going to find employment in that field. If you look at the job requests on Monster, you'll see where they're really looking to steal people from other companies that are, because companies do not want to train their workers.
I think you're right
anymore
on this one, Nancy, and I think to add to that point, I think I will amplify your point by saying, you know, that the fact that education is so expensive, and beyond the fact that education is so expensive, the fact that a lot of these students are dealing with mounds and mounds of student loan debt, and at the same time while that's happening, you know, millionaires and billionaires are paying a lower rate on their corporate, on their capital gains tax. You know, it's quite troubling. Now, I have a question for you, Nancy. So you live in Michigan. What's your whole take on the governor's move to sort of, I guess, impeach the city council of the state of in the city of Detroit?
Well, you know, it's an emergency manager, and it's very unfortunate. I live in the suburbs, but I'm very supportive of the city of Detroit, and it's made me sad to see kind of a regional argument. My wealthy county kind of condemns the county that Detroit is in over and over again. And unfortunately, we had the scandal of the former mayor going to jail. And so I have to lean a little bit towards installing the emergency manager simply because they have such huge problems that they have not been able to solve.
But Nancy,
for
do you
my
think
whole
that
lifetime,
do,
decades.
But, So I have another question for you, Nancy. So based on I hear what you're saying, but do you think that it's okay for them to get rid of the democratically elected mayor and the democratically elected officials?
Well, I think they're still going to be there. It's just that the officials won't get paid. And, you know, it's just a very difficult question that you're asking me, which outcome will be better. And I don't know which outcome will be better. I've seen that the government just can't seem to get their financial game together, and, you know, it's a big problem, but I don't blame those officials that would lose their leadership role. I blame the whole state for treating Detroit like an orphan child for years and years and years and not wanting to support the city or realize that none of these people in the state in all of these suburbs would be making the money they're making if it weren't for the city of Detroit that they are next to. And I'd like to also point out that getting back to my position about the students taking so much risk is that now that we've become a right-to-work state, I fear that these young people, they're going to get to be 40 and they're going to be fired so that the company can hire a younger person for less money, and I'll hang up and listen to your reply.
Oh, I definitely agree with you there, Nancy. I think, you know, having individuals, I completely agree. It shouldn't be. I think in this country, like I said, the land of where we have like plenty. It's plenty. You go on Wall Street and you just see plenty. So people living the high life on the backs of middle class and working class families, and yet these same individuals who they pump money into Washington. And they make sure that they keep their legislature friends there. They want to do absolutely positively nothing to, you know, maintain the working class and the middle class in this country. And I think that is the most disheartening thing for me. I think it should be the most disheartening thing for a lot of Americans that we see we have a Congress here that's not willing to raise the minimum wage, that's not willing to raise taxes. And I wouldn't say raise taxes. I would say close loopholes on millionaires and billionaires so that, you know, every American has a fair shot at the American dream. It's quite sad. It's very, very sad, Nancy. We have a caller calling from Oak Brook, Chicago, who's upset about the gentleman that said, our money is not our money. Donald. Why are you upset about these things?
Well, the thing is, you know, what really gets me, it's they seem to use that as a club to beat a Democratic politician over the head with. Like, and I'm referring to Mitt Romney's case when he came over to here in Winnetka. He was either in Winnetka or Schaumburg, and he jumped all over this girl that was asking him about the health care, about women's health care, who would pay for that if they don't have enough money. He jumped on her and said, listen, he said, and he was very rude about it too, Mitt Romney. He said, you think that these taxpayers here, you're going to use their money to take care of your health care and your abortions and your... He jumped all over here. Why is it that it becomes our money when they want to say, when they want to use it as a club? How come it's not our money when they want to start two illegal wars? It seems to be all of a sudden their money, according to that one politician. I like to really let him have it and give him a little piece of my mind. But, you know, this is what I mean about this here thing. They want to turn this government into a government that works solely for themselves. They want to divorce this government from its people. They want to form all these symbiotic relationships with millionaires and billionaires for their own personal existence, and they're going to keep it going for themselves. They want to cut out everything for the middle class.
Listen, Donald, I agree with you on that. It's their money when it comes to, you know, increasing and quadrupling our defense budget, but it's not their money when it comes to making sure that they don't throw grandma off the cliff, or it's not their money when you want to make sure poor kids go to college or middle-class families get a chance at the American dream. Then it becomes the people's money, and the people have to be in control of their money. It's quite sad. It's quite disheartening. And I think that sort of harkens back to the Bush administration. That, you know, I know people are going to get mad for me going back to the Bush administration, but it wasn't our money when they gave no-bid contracts to Halliburton, or when they had two wars that were unpaid for and a prescription drug bill that was unpaid for. But all of a sudden, when President Obama is in office, now it's the American people's money, and we need to give it back to people so they can have quote-unquote prosperity. Donald, I hear you on that one. Listen, folks, I got to tell you, this whole conference, this whole CPAC conference, this is my first time, so I will admit that I'm a first-time CPACer. And it's a very, very, very interesting, little conference. It's not little by no stretch of the imagination. But I will say this, there is no diversity here. Haven't seen much. Either way, we want to take your call, so keep calling in. We want to hear your calls, so don't keep calling in. We'll be here. We have one more segment left. Richard Fowler filling in for Tom Hartman, who is not here, obviously. So we'll be right back on the Tom Hartman Show after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're back on the Tom Hartman Program. No, I'm not Tom Hartman, even though I sort of look like him from the side, from a distance. We're back here at the CPAC 2013 conference. Listen, folks, so I got a tweet in. Somebody tweeted me and asked, so what's the diversity, ratio here? And to that particular tweeter, I don't know. I've seen a couple of flies in the jug of milk. And there's a African American down the way. So I think it's moderately diverse. I do want to take this caller, though, because I think it's probably interesting on this fine Thursday. It should be probably one of our last callers. But Gina says that folks on the minimum wage should not rely on the government, and I just really want to hear what she's saying. She's calling from Oklahoma. Gina, tell me, what are your thoughts?
Yes. I do believe in raising minimum wage, and I do believe in absolutely giving every American the opportunity to go after that American dream. We are in the land of plenty, but I do think that because we are in the land of plenty, I'm not sure how you address the impact of personal responsibility. You can give someone all the money in the world that would raise them to that middle class level, but at the end of the day, it's the choices that individual makes with those dollars that impact their
Now, Gina, I hear you on that point, and I think, you know, to some extent, yeah, there is a level of personal responsibility, but what's the trade-off, Gina? Like, so a mother's not responsible, so her child deserves to go hungry? Or a father's not responsible because he's in jail, so the whole family has to go hungry and has to, you know, be in poverty for the rest of their lives? Like, I just don't understand the dichotomy. Understandably, people make personal choices, just like the Wall Street bankers did, you know, during the TARP bailout. They made personal choices. They made choices to invest in dodgy investments. And because of that, you know, even though they made bad choices, guess what? The American people bailed them out, which is the sad part.
And I'm with you. I'm asking myself the same question. What is the trade-off, and how much can we regulate? I think the key is, because I don't know what the key is, but there has to be some way to regulate that, whatever program that is, whether you want to call it an entitlement program or not, there's got to be some accountability. And I don't know how that comes in, because, quite frankly, I don't want the government to tell me how I should spend my dollars. I don't at all, and I don't believe in that. But, like you said, you make a perfect example. The mother who chooses not to take care of her child, it's not that child's fault. But do you continue to give that mother those dollars when you know those dollars aren't going to the child? I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I hear you, Gene, and that's why the government, you know, there's a lot of stopgaps. I think one of those stopgap measures when it comes to, like, people think, and I don't want to go off on this tangent towards the end of the show, because I think I'll talk about this all day. People think that being on welfare is like an easy thing. Like, there's all these welfare queens driving around in Cadillacs, and, you know, all their kids wear Jordans. That's just not true. I mean, being on welfare is a hard thing to do. I mean, you have to go to classes, you have to apply for jobs, you have to be, because of the welfare to work pipeline, you have to do a lot of stuff. Like, I'm not saying that you should stay on welfare. I'm saying that being on welfare is not like a situation where you're sitting at home twiddling your thumbs, you know, and the government just keeps writing you checks. You know,
And that's where I wonder, you know, I wonder if the way food stamps work, for example, or the way the WIC program works, we're going to give you these dollars, but you're only going to be allowed to spend these dollars on certain things for a period of time while you continue to do the things we're asking you to do, to either raise your level of maturity so that you understand the accountability and the responsibility that you hold in your actions. You know, maybe something continuing along those same lines, but can we take it a step further, or do we need to take it a step further? I'm not sure.
You know, Gina, and I appreciate your call, because I think the conversation that you're having is a conversation that we need to have within the progressive movement. I don't think they're having this conversation at CPAC, because I think they're trying to figure out a way to cut on the backs of middle class and working class families here to instill their conservative values. And I think the other problem, the other issue with CPAC here, talking about children, which is always the hypocrisy of the Republican Party. They only care about children when they're fetuses, but when that child's born, you know, they want all the programs to stop, because they'll put a hacksaw to WIC programs, they'll put a hacksaw to all the programs you mentioned, Gina, and at the same time, they want that child to be born, but they don't care about it once it is born, which is the sad part, and, you know, the irony of the conservative movement. But, Gina, we thank you so much for calling. We appreciate you so much. We have time for one more call, and I think we'll take Mark, who says he has a foolproof plan for immigration. Now, Mark, if you could tell us your foolproof plan to immigration in 30 seconds, I'll give you a cookie, I promise. Mark, 30 seconds.
Hello. All right. First, there's two options with my plan. First is go the normal route and fill out all the paperwork, wait your time in line, and become a citizen that way. It takes roughly about 11 years. I have a personal friend who just went through that.
What happens to all those folks, the 11 million living here?
But that's part two.
Okay. Well, if you have 30 seconds, time is ticking.
Okay, 30 seconds. Second one, amnesty for all, but you're not allowed to vote for 20 years.
You're not allowed to vote for 20 years after you become a full-fledged citizen?
No, that's during the whole process. If you just want to stay here and not fill out the paperwork, there's two paths you can go down. Fill out the paperwork, do it the correct way that everyone from Parris Island,
I don't know about that,
relatives and whatnot.
You
can stay here and you can't vote.
I don't know about that one. If you're paying taxes in this country, you should have the right to vote. I'm sorry.
And you should also have to fill out the paperwork, too.
I agree, Mark. I think you should. I think there should be a pathway where you have to get a stand in line. But at the same time, if you're a citizen and you're paying taxes here and you've come out the shadows, you should have the right to vote. But we appreciate you. Thank you for your 30-minute solution to immigration. I don't think it's fully feasible, but it's good. Either way, listen, folks, that's the end of our time here. Tomorrow, don't worry, Tom is going to be back. I'll be back as well. And there's also going to be brunch with Bernie, so Bernie Sanders will be here. But we don't want you to go anywhere. You come back with us at CPAC 2013 tomorrow. This is Richard Fowler on behalf of Tom Hartman and everybody at the Hartman University. Have a good evening and see you tomorrow.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.